We celebrate 100 episodes with Brian Redman.
Brought to you by NineWorks.co.uk, the fastest growing online Porsche community, supported by the NineWorks Marketplace. NineWorks Radio is your dedicated Porsche and car podcast, hosted by Lee Sibley, Andy Brooks, and Max Newman. NineWorks Radio is carefully produced with special input from experts around the industry and powered by our valued members of the NineWorks Driven Not Hidden Collective.
Boys,
100
100 NineWorks Radio episodes. That's amazing,
isn't it? Just who would have thought it? From the first episode where you were stood on top of the Porsche building,
Porsche Museum, yeah, that's it, yeah, on Porsche Platz.
100 episodes ago, that was.
Yeah, yeah, we did sound night, didn't we? Sound
it was,
naps, and
yeah.
I was teasing you with the sounds, you had to guess the models.
Oh yeah, I didn't enjoy that. I don't think I got one right.
Well, here we are, we're 100 episodes later on. I want to say a big hello to everybody listening.
Hello.
If you don't know, it's the three amigos that have been here for the majority of the 100 episodes. Myself, Lee Sibley, Andy Brooks is next to me.
Good day.
And then we've got Max Newman as well. How you doing, Max?
Yeah, pretty good. I'm on the other end of the Zoom.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, look, we, as you may have guessed, we're kind of celebrating a milestone for us, really, but hopefully for you as well, if you've listened to a proportion of those 100 episodes
you
along the way.
Poor buggers having to listen to all that. How many hours is that?
Yeah, yeah. There's hopefully some decent content in there along the way, amongst the derriere.
how many hours it is. I dread to think. It's a lot of hours.
Yeah. It's got to be approaching...
I wouldn't want to guess.
160, 170, I guess.
Must be.
I wouldn't want to guess, and I certainly wouldn't want to tell the wife, that's for sure. So, yes, but we're feeling quite chuffed. We've got a special guest to bring to you in celebration of reaching 100 episodes because, I mean, yeah, it's cliched, but we couldn't do it without our audience listening. It's as simple as that. And before we kick things off, I want to give a little shout out as well to Neil Plumpton as well, who joined us for a proportion of those 100 episodes. As the fourth amigo at some point. So Neil, yeah, raising an alcohol-free beer in your direction as well, mate.
Yeah.
Thank you for your inputs.
Raising a coffee to Neil. He's probably listening to us at Milk Coffee in Sidcup, which is his own coffee shop, which is open since he was on the pod. So he's rocking along with that and having a good time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're going to have to try some of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be good gear. You know that. Neil's
putting it together. Good gear. Love it. I guess before we dive into the legend and genuinely like an absolute Premier League Porsche legend we've got on the pod shortly, but before we dive into that, like what have we learnt, boys, over the last 100 episodes, if anything?
God, lots learnt.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely shit. I shouldn't swear.
A lot.
Absolutely loads, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so much.
I tell you what we've learned. We've learned how much I enjoy being part of a community of like-minded individuals who are happy to get deep in a subject that's close to everyone's heart and just really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I think the last 100 episodes has certainly taught me that the Porsche scene that we're all involved in to some extent is more diverse than ever, and actually therefore our experience and hopefully everybody else's experience is enriched kind of more than ever really. So much to be kind of contributing. It's a real melting pot, you know, and it's kind of long gone, I think, is the assumption of being, you know, male and middle-aged and into your golf, you know, therefore you need a 911. It's kind of, you know, no, there's so many kind of different factions, but that kind of sounds adversarial, so that's probably not the correct word. But yeah, so many kind of little niches that contribute to the larger thing, and you
it's
know,
multifaceted, isn't it?
Oh, there we go, Max. Check that out. You've had your coffee. You've had your coffee.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I think that's the greatest thing. You know, we've heard some absolutely amazing stories from all sorts of different people all over the planet, and the only thing that connects all of that is a love of Porsche sports cars. It's pretty mental, actually, when you think about it.
Absolutely.
obviously, within all of that as well, we've seen the birth of the DNHC, the Dreadnought Hidden Collective, which we don't need to evangelise so much, I guess, because we've done it a lot, but it's still bloody awesome.
It is, yeah. It's over a year old now, isn't it? Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Once we've formulated what the DNHC is and released it to the public as well, yeah, it's a year old now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is mad. Andy, you and I did a bonus podcast a couple of weeks ago.
We did, yes.
That was for our Works and Hero Drivers. It was a long one, wasn't it? A good 45 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
And that seemed to go down well. It was a really candid chat between you and I and all of those guys and girls, but just kind of our feelings, really, on the first year of the pod.
Yeah, feelings of where we've been, what we've been doing, and kind of what our overall ethos is, I guess.
Yeah. Are there any parts of that conversation as a top line you'd like to share with everybody else?
I think we had a bit of a realization, didn't we, about our, you know, what are we? What are we about? And it's going back to what Patreon was set up for and the DNHC was set up for, and that's for you know, the good listeners and viewers and readers to say thank you for the output for those videos, those podcasts, and the written content that we put out. That's what it's primarily about, and that's what our output is. We do events and, you know, collaborate with events, but that's not our 100% thing.
Yeah.
There's a much more deep side of it, I guess.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And we said, you know, it's the role of what we do in running, I guess, the DNHC is, you know, it's not to compete with others that are doing events. It's to add to those events. You know, really, we are content focused. That's, I think, our USP and where we sit. So that's how I view it anyway, how, you know, where we sit.
Absolutely. And bring everything, kind of bring everything together as well. So we're doing lots of collabs with people at other people's events where we add to the atmosphere and bring the Nineworks special sauce, as it were.
Yeah. And the Nineworks magic. Definitely. That was the biggest thing. So it's been a fun year, you know, lots learned, like, definitely.
Yeah. But I think really the biggest thing to come out of it is the community, isn't it? That, you know, there's so many people that, really good people that will go along to whoever's events, whatever thing that's going on, and they'll get together and they feel that they're like family and able to enjoy each other's company and not just sort of, all right, mate.
Yeah, exactly that. And also in being kind of content led and, you know, Works and level drivers and above, they, you know, there's lots of bonus content coming. We'll talk about some of that shortly, actually. But that's what we're about, and that's where anybody can get the true value of the DNHC, regardless of where you live. So you don't have to live in the south of the UK where we do to get the benefit of the DNHC. You know, you can live in New Zealand and hopefully still get that benefit. So it was nice to share our thoughts on that. A few other candid bits which we'll kind of keep exclusive to that podcast, I guess. But we just want to say thanks to the Hero and Works drivers for the lovely feedback off the back of that. I don't know about you, that's definitely put some more fire in the belly for year two. And
absolutely, yeah.
And everything else.
Yeah, there's so many kind comments that, you know, agreed with what we were saying. And we're also thankful that we put that together, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think it's cemented in their minds as to what the DNHC means to them and what Nineworks means to them.
Yeah.
What it's all about, you know, what the goals are, what's the strap line almost.
I guess exactly that. Yeah, so sorry, Max, did you want to?
It was a nice bit of, you know, I absorbed that as a community member and listener, and it was, and as you say, the feedback reflected the fact that it, you know, there were some vulnerabilities that you guys put out there. It was a sort of cultural positioning piece that you didn't have to do, but everybody, you know, a lot of the feedback just came back and it was like, yes, you know, that's what we feel as well. You know, thank you for expressing that, because that's how we feel as members of the DNHC. So it's nice to just to have that, to take that moment, and then, as you say, to move forward into year two, you know, having done so. It was good. It was a good thing to do.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Max, and thank you to everybody that contributed to that. And, you know, again, if you're listening and you're not part of the Driven Not Hidden collective, as Andy would say, come on in, the water's warm.
And the air.
And the air, yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And the oil. And the oil, yes, indeed.
Yeah. So you can take a look at it's patreon.com/nineworks and choose the membership level that's right for you. And we look forward to welcome you at some point.
Indeed.
So just on, before we move on to other stuff and the legendary Brian Redman, there's some bonus stuff that we're going to do bi-weekly for Works Drivers. And Andy and Max, you've done the first episode.
We have indeed, yes.
What is it?
I would think Max should announce the name because he was the good guy that came up with it.
The name is Heels on... No.
No.
Head... Heels on wheels.
Heels on wheels. No. Oi, oi.
I've always wanted some of those. Those little shoes with the wheels in the back. What are they called? Heelys or wheelies? Have you ever seen those?
I've seen the Heelys. Yeah,
they're cool. I've always wanted some of those.
Oh, dear.
But they don't come out all sizes. So anyway, that aside, yeah. Head over heel. No.
It's really memorable.
Shambles, boys. Shambles.
Oh, my God.
How have we got to 100 episodes leading this shit
show? So the idea that we came up with is called Head Over Wheels.
Head Over Wheels.
That's it. I knew it was a good name. I just couldn't remember it.
Oh, dear. So the idea came to me one early Saturday morning, I think it was. And it's basically we want to get to know each other better. We want to get to know our audience, and we feel that our audience should get to know each other. So the idea is to have every other week is a one-on-one interview, chat. Let's call it a chat.
Interview
is not the right thing. Taking one of our works or hero drivers and having a like pub-like type chat with them, find out about their reason for being here, I guess, in the DNHC. Why are you head over wheels? What has made you become this maniac about cars and
your
Porsche
car journey, I guess?
Yeah. But we want to keep it quite relaxed, so there's no formulated sort of questions. Let's keep it sort of fresh and organic and just have a little chat like you would down the pub. And first one was me having a chat with Max about his head over wheels, and it's quite informative. There's many bits that I didn't know about you. Who would have thought? Was it Bugatti honorary membership or something?
Life membership. I'm a life member of the Bugatti Owners Club.
What the hell? Yeah.
I think we didn't really talk about Porsche very much at all, other than my first Porsche, which we talked on because we got up to there in the journey, didn't we? Car life. But it was, but mostly prior to 2012 when I bought that car, it was from from 1976 to 2012 sort of thing.
Finding out the backstory on Max. So it was good. It's really good.
Did he mention the restraining orders or is that? Are you keeping that off the record?
Well, that's not car stuff. So I didn't think that was relevant.
Quality. I'm looking forward to listening to that. That's going to be awesome. Yeah, Mr. Bugatti, mate. Mr. Bugatti.
Yeah, who'd have believed it? Yeah.
Who'd have thought?
Yeah, so you're doing the next one, aren't you, Max?
Yeah. I'm gonna hang out with Toby.
Yeah. Have you organised that?
No. I was thinking about that. I was wondering if I could use, because I think Toby and I will probably have to Zoom on that.
Yes. Yeah.
I wondered if I could use the Zoom and just
record it
like we're doing this.
Yeah, yeah, we'll
and
do
then
that.
There's
no
less opportunity for me to cock it up.
No problem. All good.
And like when I get together with someone like James Good, who's fairly local to me, we probably will do that in the field, he and I. We'll probably have to do that two or three times before I manage to record it properly.
Yeah. All you got to do is hit the red button. That's the most important thing is hit that red button. Speaking from experience. So.
I think you've got somebody lined up as well. You're going out to Ireland?
Yes, I'm going to speak to, James Chew.
We've got a couple lined up.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to Guy Feltham as well, obviously, off the back of him ditching Rothmans. If you've not seen it, dearest listeners, by the way, and read it, he's done a fantastic My Porsche story on the website. and just talking about his Porsche ownership journey, which is titled How to Give Up Smoking, because the Rothmans livery GT3, which you would have seen if you've been to any Cars and Coffee in the UK or ever been on Instagram, he's moved on to the 911 RS. I think you guys shouted out that on the last episode.
We did, yeah.
So yeah, I just want to pass on my warm wishes to Guy. So we're going to have a chat about his car story in the run-up to that. There were some nice little bits in that article that I'd quite like to pick up on.
Yeah, it's quite interesting actually, because, you know, is there a crossover? Yeah, I guess there is a crossover, but the my Porsche stories are very sort of, I don't quite public, you know, they're on the website, where these chats are going to be family kept, as it were.
Yeah.
They're only available on the Patreon.
Yes.
We can be very relaxed and candid. And,
yeah. You know, and also, yeah. And, you know, my Porsche story is, it is exactly that, you know, and that's what we want it to be. Now, these, you know, as you and I found, Andy, we talked about all sorts of stuff. You know, it's kind of like, I was thinking, you know, how do you end up being so into Porsche that you want to be part of a collective that's Porsche focused?
Yeah.
You know, have you been into Porsche all your life, or are you just into Porsche? And, you know, why is that?
What's the backstory?
That's sort of where our conversation ended up going. And that's why it's so, you know, so interesting and so curious.
Yeah. I think it's going to be great for the community. I think it's going to really, you know, spark up conversations when, you know, somebody's at a Cars and Coffee and go, oh, your guy. Yeah, I heard your story.
Yeah.
You did that when you were a kid. My God. You know, it's going to really bring us all together. I think it's be great.
100%. 100%. Yeah. The first thing I'm going to ask Guy with this 911.1 RS he's now got is, has he and will he ever use the very superfluous pit speed limiter that car has?
It is.
I was thinking about this, of any option on any Porsche ever, I think that is the most superfluous thing in the world. It's about as useful as an ashtray on a motorbike. Do you know what I mean?
What's the speed? What does it limit it to?
I think, isn't it, is it 50 kilometres, so 30 mile an hour?
I
think, yeah, you know, which, you know, great if you're in the WEC and you're coming into the pits, but like if you're just pootling along the M25 or whatever, you know, it's a road car. It's just, it's funny, you know, that I mean, it's not an option, is it, actually? It's standard spec on the 911.1 RS, but they dropped it after that. I think they realised this is a bit silly. Yeah, and I'm just thinking, you know, if anybody else listening can think of a more pointless option or gimmick or whatever on a Porsche ever that can beat the pit speed limiter, please let me know, because again, it's, you know, it's like an ejector seat in a helicopter. It's just a complete waste of time, basically, you know, so...
Although you say that, I reckon Guy can use that when he goes to Lincoln Inn Fields for the Porsche Club GB London region Sunday morning meet. I reckon he'll be using that. Once he gets inside the congestion zone, he can just go along on the pit speed limiter.
Right, yeah.
Keep him at 30. Although there might be 20 in London now, so he'll be over.
Yeah,
I reckon that's when he'll use it.
No doubt.
Indeed.
Right, grandiose. So shall we... Well, have we got any other admin before we move on?
No, let's...
Let's dive in, yeah?
Let's,
okay.
Get our grand guest on to celebrate 100 episodes.
Fantastic. Well, like, obviously, it's pre-recorded, Andy. You and I spoke to Brian last week. Like, how good was it to chat to Brian?
Amazing. He's got some stories, that's for sure.
So many stories. And I mentioned in our chat, actually, that about his book. I can't remember, actually, the name of it now. Daring Drivers, Deadly Tracks. Genuinely is one of the best books I've read.
You've read it a couple of times.
I mean, it's a big old tome. It's kind of the way it's presented, it's more of a coffee table thing because it's massive. You know, you'd struggle reading it in bed, for example, you know, but it's just an absolutely brilliant book that paints such a vivid picture of what it was like racing in the 60s and 70s, very different to today. And just like the mindset. It's so different when you're jumping into cars, not really knowing if you're going to get out afterwards.
Yeah.
It's kind of things that people these days, motorsport has always and will always be dangerous, but
nothing compared to what it was.
No, not at all. You know, and some of the stories, it's incredible. The photography is amazing, but Brian, as you're about to find out, is a really good storyteller.
Yeah.
And it comes across in the book. So if you've not read it, like, please absolutely do so.
And impersonator as well.
He's a great impersonator, isn't he? Isn't he just, you know? And, you know, again, how I feel about it is it's important that people like Brian are able to tell his story, because it's a really, really, really important part of not just Porsche history, but motoring and motor racing history.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. I actually looked up post-interview Brian's age, And you know, what a guy, basically. Mm. What a guy, you know, 86, didn't realize.
Yeah.
But you know, with the energy of a 21-year-old, absolutely, I think, you know. Yeah. So it was, yeah, it was absolutely,
he's still got the petrol going through his veins, I think.
Without a doubt, yeah, you know, and it, I think that is one of the greatest pleasures, generally, you know, genuinely saying here, this one of the greatest pleasures of the last 100 episodes was talking to Brian. Because, yeah, just what a guy. So he's going to share some parts from his incredible career, and we very much hope you enjoy it.
Indeed. Let's roll.
I can't wait to listen to this. You know, I as we record, I haven't heard this, and I love the fact that I still get to enjoy some segments of this podcast as a listener, and I can't wait for it.
The legendary Brian Redman, a big warm welcome, good sir, to the 100th episode of Nineworks Radio.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and very thankful to be here, to be quite honest.
Bless you, bless you. Well, as I said, like we're in the presence of a legend. You've quite literally done everything, won everything, raced everything, and with so many legendary drivers at all manner of circuits around the world, which we'll dive into. It's such a unique career you've had that's just completely punctuated by success almost every step of the way, incident packed as well, which of course we'll go into. I know you, you're Florida based these days, born and raised over on this side of the pond in Lancashire. I'd love to know, first of all, if there's any parallels that can be drawn between the two.
Not really, no.
When, well, are you coming back?
Because I was born in, you know, when we came to America in 1980, I came in 1980, but Marion and the children came about 82. We thought that the things we didn't care for in the American system would eventually get sorted out. And they primarily were the gun situation,
yeah,
and the political situation and the far-right religious situation. And certainly in amongst that is the health situation.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. It's worse now than it was 43 years ago.
Wow. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, hopefully cheer you up somewhat by talking about your racing career. So again, I mean, there's and the thing is, I know I'm going to miss some pieces out here, but this is just to give some kind of top level for those that perhaps aren't in the know as to your career, and certainly like at your wins, for example, because it really does read as a what of the global racing program. So, you know, 12 Le Mans races, 2 class wins, Daytona winner on 3 occasions, Sebring twice, Kyalami twice, Brands Hatch twice, the Targa Florio race, I can't wait to talk about that, 1,000 kilometers in the Nürburgring twice, 1,000 kilometers of Spa 4 times, in terms of people. And again, I apologize in advance because I know I've missed people out here, but just from maybe a Porsche persuasion, you've raced and shared cars with the likes of Richard Atwood, Jackie Ickx, Vic Elford, Joe Siffert, Seppi, I know you call him, Derek Bell, Peter Gregg, John Fitzpatrick, Hurley Haywood and Dick Barber. Incredible. And then, amazing, you know, cars again is obviously the GT40 and a fair few Lolas in there, but from Porsche wise, 908, 917, 935, 962, you know, is there anything you look back on, whether it's cars, tracks, wins or people, where you think, I really like to have done that? Because it feels like you've just done everything, Brian.
Yeah. What did you miss?
Yeah. Well, the one thing, there are two things really, in, you know, a lengthy career, interrupted by problems from time to time, was Indianapolis. I would like to have done Indy, and I was actually offered twice. But in 1974, I had an offer to do Indy. But that year, USAC, that's United States Automobile Club, and that's, these are what we call the roundy-roundy guys, the Indianapolis. They only did, you know, ovals at that time.
Yeah,
they,
yeah,
joined Formula 5000 road racing. Open wheel, single seater, engine limited to 5 liters, so about 500 horsepower. But they only weighed, you know, 1,250 pounds, so they were light. And they were very good. Well, USAC joined with the SCCA, the Sports Car Club of America. And suddenly into the series came these new USAC drivers for us: Mario Andretti, Bobby Unser, Al Unser, Gordon Johncock, Johnny Rutherford, and others, all Indy winners. And they all struggled except for Mario. Mario was brilliant, from the start, but even the youngsters who were really good and learning very fast, they still, you know, didn't actually really get road racing. And so when I was offered the Indy Drive, I thought, boy, these great Indy drivers are struggling with road racing. It'll be the same for me. And I thought, I don't want to spend a year figuring out how to do oval racing. But yeah, looking back, I should have done it. And then the second time was, of course, 1977. So I'd won three American Formula 5000 championships, with Mario finishing second for 2 years. And Alan Sr. was second the third year. And, of course, they changed the rules. They made us put bodywork on the open-wheel single-seater. And the first event of the new year, in 1977, my new car, which I hadn't seen before, Sandra Beat in Canada, I get there, but it's prepared by Chaparral, you know, who I'd raced for 4 years with such great success. And I go out. I come in after 20 minutes. I'm at that point, I'm 3 seconds faster than anybody else.
Oh, my word.
So Jim Hall said, "How is it?" I said, "It's good." And he said, "You know, what do you want to do to change the balance?" And I said, "Drop the front wing a quarter of an inch, not much." And on the next lap, at 170 miles an hour, it took off at the top of the hill. I turned over and came down. Unfortunately, it went about 40 feet in the air, came down upside down. The roll bar broke. I went down on the road to rub my helmet away each side. It broke my neck, C1, my shoulder, split my breastbone, broke my ribs, and my heart stopped. But fortunately, as it rolled off the road, off the track, the surrounding land was lower, and so it landed on its wheels. And the track doctor was a heart specialist, and so he got my heart going. Then the ambulance blew a tire on the way to hospital. And when Marion arrived from England the next morning, there was a photograph on the front page of the Montreal paper, and it showed the ambulance with the doors open and me in the back not looking too good. And the headline was, "Redman et moi." Redman is dead. And so I was due to drive an IndyCar the following week.
Wow.
So, of course, that never happened. So that's a regret. And of course, Le Mans, I mean, I'd won all the other great, you know, world championship races several times. But Le Mans, well, we won the class twice, 1978 and 18. Of course, today, anybody that wins a class in Le Mans, they say, "We won Le Mans."
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I've never said that, and I will never say it. I say, "I won the class at Le Mans." Genuinely, you know, in a place to win at least four times. You know, in 1969, the new 917 had come out, and we were offered a choice of the 917 or a new long-tail Spider 908. Well, Joseph and I had won like probably three or four races by that time in the 908, so it was very reliable. So we chose the open new Spider, and we were leading about 8 in the evening, and the gearbox overheated. It had never been tested with that long tail. And then in 1970, we're leading by 4 laps.
Oh, my word.
9:17. And about 1 in the morning, a terrible wet race, about 1 in the morning, Seppert comes past the pits. He's overtaking 3 slower cars that are all having their own race. And he dives across to the right, and right in front of the Porsche pit, Mr. Gear. It was very easy to do in the 917. Very slow, synchromesh gearbox. And that was that. And then we were leading in 1980 with John Fitzpatrick in the 935. And it went on to 5 cylinders at about 4 and 5 in the morning. It was funny, really, because Dick Barber, the team owner, and who's driving with us, of course, as happens today, doesn't it? These people that have the means to do it, and they rent a couple of good young guys, and off they go. So I'd come in, and I was wet and cold. It's 4 in the morning. We're on 5 cylinders, but you wait and see, you know, that the car's okay. So he comes in the pit, and so I see his arm waving through the rain. So I run around to the driver's door, and he says, "Brian, you guys are paid to drive in conditions like this. Get back in." So that was another one gone. And then possibly 1979, I get a call from Porsche. "Edmund, You would like to do Le Mans with Jackie Ickx? It was a 9:36. So my first lap in the race, I come through the Ford chicane, and in those days, the pit entrance was just past the chicane. You know, as today, some miles back in the wonder. So as I came through the chicane on my first lap in the race, the car didn't feel quite right. And I should have just gone straight into the pits. I could have done. And I thought, no, it's me. And I didn't have time to think, really. I carried on. So I arrive at the Dunlop Curve at 180 miles an hour and spin. What I felt was the left rear tire going down. I spun all the way around the Dunlop Curve. I hear the body crashing and things coming off. And then I saw the wall, the barrier coming at me like this. I just swerved and missed it. And in the toolkit, we carried a very comprehensive toolkit, spare, fuel pump, belt, hammer, a sack saw, actually a pad saw, you know, wow. Pad saw blade. And I drove to Eau Rouge, the start of the Mulsanne, where there was room to pull off. So I pulled off, I cut the tire off the rim, and then I did a very, very slow lap, you know, with the wheel, the left rear wheel on the verge where I could. So this all takes at least half an hour. You know, and I get back to the pits, and I think, well, this is it, we're out. Yeah. No, half an hour later, it's going. So we're now last, and we start, you know, climbing up. So at about 1 a.m, the rain is pouring down. Lightning, thunder, all the rest. I'm above the pits with my oldest friend, Ian Green, also from Burnley. And suddenly on the little monitor in the box there, Ickx is stopped on the Mulsanne. So 20 minutes later, Ickx is going again. Two minutes later, Ickx is stopped again. He's now at the Mulsanne corner. He's stopped again. Well, the fuel pump drive belt had broken, and he changed it for the spare one that we had in the kit. So that broke. So now I know we're out. This is it. Finished. I was not unhappy with the weather conditions. Well, half an hour later, Ickx is going again. He comes in.
Relentless.
And Norbert Singer, the team manager, looks up and sees me and he goes, so down I go. So I shook hands with Ian, my friend. I thought, this is it. This is the end of Brian Redman. So we shook hands. Goodbye. Ian, and so I get in, off I go. I'm driving as hard as I can in these horrible conditions. We're doing 200 miles an hour in the rain at night on the Mulsanne. Anyway, 40 minutes into what should be an hour and 20-minute session, pit. I go into the pits. Norbert Singer leans over. He says, Herr Redman, you can get out of the car. We were disqualified 1.5 hours ago.
No. You're joking me.
So what had happened was a mechanic had taken a sandwich for Jackie. And of course, part of the sandwich was a fuel pump drive belt. So the local paper the next morning, the headlines, Porsche cheating. There was another one gone. So the remaining Le Mans that I did, there was never any hope of winning. You know, in the AMR Aston Martin in 1989 and Vern Schuppen's 962, I forget what year it was, but there was no, that was the end of the hopeful winning chances. So
Some amazing stories though.
Well, it's interesting, Brian, because you know, you've got the two class wins, but do you look back on Le Mans as like unlucky for you or successful, you know, because you've had both, I guess.
Yeah.
And in terms of, I tried to avoid lucky things like walking under ladders. So if I saw a ladder at a racetrack, I'd walk under it.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to, not tempting fate, but it was lucky in some, I was very lucky, you know, to get away with 3 major accidents. And actually still continue, never mind still being alive or able. So I was lucky in that sense. Certain tracks were very lucky in America, the Mid-Ohio track. For like 10 years, I was first or second there in various things. And so I try not to have a feeling of what might be lucky or might not be lucky, you know, because superstition and stuff.
Yeah. For those listening that might not know, you know, the period you raced was basically through the 60s, 70s and 80s. It was very different, of course, compared to today, like mainly from like a safety point of view. You mentioned in great detail about your book, and I need to mention this to people at home. It's a fantastic tome. I've read it twice. It's one of my favourite books, Brian, and I really mean that. I'm not just saying that because you've joined us for the conversation today. It's Daring Drivers, Deadly Tracks, and I really encourage all of our Nineworks Radio listeners to have a read. It's fantastic. Some brilliant pictures in there. Well, loads of brilliant pictures in there. And you talk in detail, Brian, about the safety of racing at the time or lack thereof.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, my first Grand Prix, Formula One for Cooper, and Kyle Army in South Africa in January 1968, only half the drivers wore a seatbelt.
Wow.
Because of fire. The fire was the great danger. I was actually in about 6 fires in a 4-year period. I mean, the bloody things caught fire all the time. I remember at Brands Hatch in the Lola T100 Formula 2 car, I'm whistling down towards Clearways, and it misses a bit, you know, and it feels a bit funny. And I look in the mirrors, and it's caught fire. Caught fire at the Nürburgring in the new Chevron B16 Spider in September 1970. Car was fantastic. I'm leading by 2.5 minutes. I come over a 14-kilometer jump in top gear, so probably 130 or so. And as it goes in the air, of course, I back off. And as it landed, I go back on the throttle, and the engine goes, wah, bah, 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 bah. And I looked at the gauge, and the fuel pressure was down like this. And stupidly, I turned on the electric fuel pump, which is only used for starting the engine. And immediately, it just went boom.
Wow.
I drove it like 3/4 of a mile up the road on the Nürburgring to the nearest Marshall's point. And by this time, when I got there, it was really blazing, you know, and I jumped out. And as I jumped out, the Marshall ran away up the road. But he left the extinguisher, and I did what I could. But the car was very badly damaged, and Chevron did an amazing job. Because in a week, in the 7 days that they had it back at Bolton, they completely rebuilt it, ready for Spa 2 weeks after the Nürburgring, where the last race of the 2-litre championship, and either Lola or Chevron were going to win it. And throughout the race, I battled, it's 500 kilometres, you know, it's a long way. I battled with Joe Bonnier, the Lola driver and Lola agent for Europe. And we passed and repassed each other. And on the next to the last lap, I couldn't get first gear at the hairpin at Last Horse. And he pulled away probably 7 or 8 car lengths. And on that lap, I went berserk, really. And I passed him and set a new lap. And that lap record that I set on that lap was 3 seconds faster than my 908 winning fastest lap just a year before, the long tail 908 with 3 liters, and this little Chevron with 1.8 liter also with FVC went 3 seconds faster. Unbelievable. Anyway, on the last lap, I get past him, and we're right at the far end at the corner of Stavolo, and I've got a few car lengths, and I think, great, you know, this is so now we're on the uphill straight, and in my mirror I saw him just coming up, you know, in the slipstream, and he just came past me. And typical Joe, when he got partway past you, he would always chop you off, and I knew this. And so the choice there is to either hit or back off. So I backed off. So now we're coming whistling into the hairpin, Lassos, on the last corner of the last lap, and I've been catching him there a little bit on braking all through the race. Well, now he's on the inside, I'm on the outside. And we passed what I felt was my last braking place. I mean, I didn't use braking points, but, you know, feel. And so I took the escape road, braking up the escape road until I thought I could turn, then I will turn, thinking I'm going to see Joe crossing the finishing line and the checkered flag. He spun and he was sideways across the track. So Chevron won the championship by 1 point over
the... Wow. Wow. Amazing. And I think that that underlines, I think, the level of bravery, Brian, I think, to pedal these cars of the time. I want to highlight three kind of key incidents from your career. You know, 1968, you had a big accident at Spa, fortunate to not lose your arm, as you document in the book. 1971 at the Targa Florio, horrific accident, big burns. You know, you said that you had the appearance of a mummy, the way you were bandaged up afterwards. Then in 1977, as you spoke about just now, you know, nearly killed outright, and your heart stopped when testing that Lola T332. With that in mind, I'd like to know, you know, what goes through your mind, or what went through your mind when you're climbing into these cars at the start of a race? You know, are you and your peers thinking, I'm here to win the race today? Or are you aware of the fact that you might not finish the race alive?
Yes, very much so. In the 68, 69, and 70 period, yes. And, you know, one of the sort of great problems as a family with a small son and daughter, in those days, sort of kissing the wife goodbye on the doorstep and the two little children there. And she knew and I knew that it might be the last time. But if you don't want to do it, there's 100 people ready, waiting to take your place, aren't there? You know, and so Marion only ever said anything once, and that was after the Spa accident in the Cooper in 68. And she just said, I don't want you to race, darling. And I said, I'm not stopping. So that's all she ever said at the time.
What kept you going, Brian?
Well, it was partially, there were a couple of things, really. One was, after the first accident with the Cooper, with the compound fracture of the right forearm, I didn't actually feel anything. It was like a dream, the whole thing, from when the brakes failed, the suspension had broken. It was like a slow-motion dream. I felt my arm break as it went over the barrier. It landed on its wheels, and then three wheels came off, and I'd landed in a Marshall's point. I hit a Marshall's car, which stopped me going into the trees. But it was like a dream. I mean, there was a photographer. I was laid out on the ground. A corner worker had been badly injured by one of the three wheels that had hit him, and he had a ruptured spleen and a heart attack, and so the main emphasis, you know, was on him, of course. So I'm lying there on the ground, and a photographer called, I think it was David Phipps, was standing there looking down at me, and I'm shouting, you know, the effing steering broke. There's just like nothing, no expression, nothing, you know, just like looking down. But we were taken by helicopter to the University of Liège Teaching Hospital, where there were no specialists in those days. The head of surgery was Professor Orban, who'd been a Winston Churchill aide in World War II.
Aha, amazing.
He knew, had plenty of experience. So he got me on the table and he said, Monsieur Edmund, it may not be possible to save your arm. I smiled. I said, thank you, Professor. He said, why are you smiling? I said, because I'm here.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
I heard that they took a bit, was it a piece of your thigh bone and stitched, kind of fused that into your arm? Is that correct?
That was later.
Oh, was that later? Okay, another incident.
The first thing that happened, of course, is Monday morning, John Cooper comes around. What happened, my boy? I said, something broke, John. Ah, yes, you'll be all right. Well, next Thursday, Motoring News said Redmond claimed the steering broke. And the editor, I think it was Michael T, got a call from John Cooper, said, I want a complete retraction. It was driver error. So he said, Mr. Cooper, I suggest you look at tomorrow's Autosport on page so-and-so. And there was a photograph taken head-on just before it hit the barrier by Peter Byrne, who was having his first official assignment as a photographer. And he'd taken the shot his head on. I don't know where he was, you know, at that time during the accident. But then what happened? Because I'm in plaster up to here and I'm trying to use my arm at home, you know, cutting the hedges with an electric cutter, this sort of thing. In September, I'd gone to the local hospital, Burnley Victoria Hospital, and they'd taken one x-ray and they said it's healed. So I rang Derek Bennett at Chevron and I said, looks like my arm's all right. What's going on? move up to Aintree on Tuesday. We'll give you a run in, you know, in the B19, I think. No, the B8, the B8. So off I go to Aintree, and Derek says, do you fancy doing Springbok series in November? I said, yes, let's do it. So off we go with Paul Owens, one mechanic, of course, on an open trailer, no spares. And a man called Franz Richter was the BMW agent in Johannesburg, and he lent us a 160,000-mile pickup truck. And we did 9 hours at Kyalami. I think Tim Schenken was the coder, but then we did 3 hours at Cape Town, 3 hours at Lorenzo Marx, single-handed, and 3 hours at Bulawayo. And on the way back through Johannesburg for the next race, I rang Alex Blicknout, the organizer of the F1 and the 9 hour. I said, do you know any good bone men in the Johannesburg area? He said, yes, brain men. I know the Christian Barnard of the bone world. Christian Barnard transport. So I go to see David Rohner Friday afternoon, and he takes 20 x-rays. And he said, sit down, Brian, man. I've got two bits of bad news for you. I said, what? He said, the first is, you don't have any union of either bone in the forearm. I said, what? What's the second bit? He said, I'm going on holiday tomorrow. So I said, I've just signed a contract with Porsche. I have to be at Daytona at the end of January. This was 6 weeks away. Wow. I have to be there. He said, I'll come in tomorrow morning. We'll perform a surgery that may work and it may not. So the next morning, I opened my arm up from my wrist to my elbow on the original scar, took bone out of my hip and glued it into my arm. And he said, don't use it till you have to. And he put it in a sling, no plaster. I got to Daytona 6 weeks later, threw the sling away. I didn't tell anybody. It was five factory Porsche 908 long tails. The first year they're having a major, major attack on the world championship, manufacturers' championship. So about, I'm driving with one hand, you know, and I use this hand on the top of the wheel, but I'm not using it. And I can use it to change gear because I don't use any rotation. I just go backwards and forwards and sideways for the gearbox. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, 12 hours or so of driving like this. Anyway, about 8 in the evening, the first of the five 908s come in and pits. The engineers examine it. He said, we are finished. They will all break. We were out by midnight.
So the car broke before your arm broke. Wow. Well, I wonder what glue he used.
So we're talking about, you know, so in that accident in 1968, as explained before, it was like a dream. I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel any pain at the time. And of course, in the 71 fire, the same thing happened. I was fully conscious throughout everything, but it was just like a dream. I heard somebody screaming, and it had to be me, but it wasn't a conscious, nothing was, it was just like, and then I was blinded almost immediately. I was very, very lucky because we'd practiced driver changes against the stopwatch probably 12 times the day before. So when it hit, just before the race, again, that whole thing was bizarre, really, because I'd made this stupid retirement at the end of 70. So 71, I didn't really have a drive. Finished up driving for Sid Taylor in Formula 5000. But in sort of April, John Wire rang me and he said, Redmond, would you care to do the Targa Florio? Because Derek Bell had taken my place in the Gulf Porsche team and he'd never done the Targa and I'd won it the year before with Sifford. So this looked like a great opportunity, you know, to get back in. So I said, yes. Well, Sifford crashed the car pretty heavily the day before the race. It was rebuilt overnight. But on race day, John said to me, Redmond, would you like to start the race? I said, no, not much. Why? He said, I don't want Siffert and Rodriguez docking each other off. So I started. And right from the start, the handling wasn't normal. And I got 22 miles round the 44-mile circuit and the steering broke. And I hit a stone kilometer post right in the fuel tank, and it exploded. And just before the race, a Porsche engineer said to me, "Aaron, if you must have the accident, do not crash on the right side." Which, of course, I did, which was right in the fuel tank. Yeah, so yeah. I held my breath, shut my eyes, and hit the belt release, and it came undone. I couldn't, you know, I was so lucky with that. And I just stood, and for a fraction of a second before my eyes were closed by the fire, I saw the verge, and so I jumped. And so apparently there were some spectators there, and they were fanning me. It took 45 minutes before the helicopter was able to get to me.
Oh, excruciating.
A place that nobody knew where I was. And so it was terrible because I'm blind and I didn't want them to do anything, you know. And they kept coming in, I hear them say, "Ultra violetti contra infectione." And I say, "Go away, get away." So about probably a couple of hours later, in comes Brit Alan de Cadillac. And he says, I'm bandaged, completely bandaged and blind from head to foot. And he says, "How are you, old chap?" I said, "Not too bad. How are you?" He said, "Well, not too bad, except I can't see out of my right eye." So about 30 minutes into this, I had an urgent call of nature. And my hands are bandaged a little bit. I said, "Alan, I'm going to have to ask you for a really great favor." He said, "Yes, oh, but what can I do for you?" I said, "Could you help me to have a piece?"
Quality.
So, anyways, about 10 at night, Richard Atwood arrived and Pedro Rodriguez, and they'd come looking for me because nobody knew where I was. Wow. And they took me back to the hotel in Chaffaloup, and there was a German doctor who'd come with the Porsche team, and apparently he gave me pain-killing injections. And then the next day, Porsche and Gulf rented a jet, and that took me from Palermo to Manchester because the main burns unit in England had been closed to infection. So I went to Manchester to a small private wing of Christie's Hospital, which is really a cancer hospital. And there I was treated by another absolutely brilliant surgeon, an Australian, one of the most highly decorated surgeons, plastic surgeons in the wartime and after the war. Randall Champion, he was called, a fantastic guy. And so, you know, as you go through life, you don't meet, well, hope you don't meet too many people that you really don't like at first sight. Well, that happened with the assistant surgeon. The minute we laid eyes on each other, we hated each other. So we wait about a week, and he comes in to see what's happening to my burns before they decide what to do. And so after about a week, he said, "Okay, time to get to work. We'll operate tomorrow." And he said to his assistant, "Clean Mr. Redman up." Well, I was covered in sort of a Vaseline type stuff. My face was terrible. My nose was all twisted up and all this. And my hands in the back of my neck. So this guy says, "Sit there." So I sat on a chair and he got alcohol and cotton wool and scrubbed my bare face, bare flesh, burnt flesh and hands. I didn't say a word. So when he went out, I got down on the floor doing push-ups. And the great Scottish nursing sister came in. She said, "Mr. Redman, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm taking my mind off other things."
oh my goodness. Yeah.
Just going back again to actually at the accident time, there was no pain at all. I mean, if burns are terrible. And over the years, when I've read about perhaps local people who have said, I've let people know they wouldn't feel anything. People who might have died in a fire, in a car crash, you don't feel anything. So that's good. So it's one of the reasons I carried on. If you don't feel anything, what does it matter?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're like Lazarus, Brian, you know, yeah. You keep coming back. And I've read in the book as well. I can't remember if it was for the burns at the Targa Florio or another one of your accidents, but when a friend got on the plane and took sight of you and like the state of you, like fainted basically. And yet, you know, you're kind of conscious throughout all of this. I just find that incredible that you have the bravery to then go anywhere near a racing car again, you know?
Well, it wasn't bravery, really. It was, what am I going to do if I'm not racing?
Wow, yeah.
So, I mean, I'd been making mop heads when I started in 1959. I made mop heads, the things you clean the floors with.
That was your first job, was it?
Well, no, not really. When I was 16, I was at a boys' public school called Rossall in the north of England between Blackpool and Fleetwood. Ed Morster called me into his study. He said, Redman, I suggest you leave school. I said, really? He said, yes, we can't teach you anything. So I left at 16. I left school at 16.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say you did okay, Brian, you know.
But, you know, that's why I've just been so lucky, really.
Yeah. How did the sort of racing start then for you? What was the first thing?
Started because my grandfather on my mother's side had passed away, and he had this mop making business. Only two men worked in it, but we made mops for ICI Nobel Division in Birmingham. You know, that's their explosive division. And the normal steel clip and plate on the mop would, of course, cause sparks. So we made special mops for them with brass fittings, so there'd be no spark. So my grandfather was a real character and a great car enthusiast. He had, at the time that when he passed away, an MGA, and he'd had a TR2. In fact, when I was 17, I'd passed my driving test. I'd never been above probably 40 miles an hour in my life. And we're going to go to the Yorkshire East Coast. He was a big shooting man, you know, and so we're in his TR2, and we're on this narrow country road going across to East Yorkshire. And he goes, send it on, lad. So 50, 60, 70, 80, mm-hmm. 90, by which time I'm getting nervous. And he's puffing. You know, when he got excited, he used to start puffing. 100. That's it. First time I've ever done 100 on this road. And he was a big football fan in Burnley. And we used to go around and see him on a Sunday morning. So I go around Sunday morning. There's a fire burning in the grate. It's January cold. And he's reading today's paper, the report on the football match. He doesn't say anything. Like I'm sitting there waiting for him to finish. And he suddenly starts puffing and he scrumples the paper up and throws it in the fire. He said, now then, lad, he said, just remember this. Only thing you can believe in newspaper is name on top and the date.
He's not wrong.
So I bought a mop business from my mother for £500. And I bought a Morris 1000 traveller's car to deliver mops in. Well, I put a Shorrock supercharger on it. Shorrocks were made in Blackburn, not that far away. A roll bar on it, harder brake linings, an anti-tramp bracket. Blah, blah, blah. And I was driving like a maniac on the road. I mean, if somebody passed me, I'd go half an hour out of my way to get past again.
So I thought
I need to get on the track. So I went to Rufforth on Easter Monday, 1959. Because, you know, you didn't have, it was a one-day meeting. No roll cage, no safety belts, no fire system. And he just took a shoe whitener and painted a number on the door. That was it. That was my first race.
Amazing. Did you win it?
No, I was so nervous. When my right leg was shaking so much, I had to put my hand on my knee to hold the throttle open on the straight. So, like 2 or 3 years went by like this, you know, racing the cars I was using on the road. And in 62, September 62, when Marion and I got married, I was pretty well broke. So I went motocross, you know, motorbikes for 2 years, which was interesting. And in 65, a friend of mine, Gordon Brown, who had the five-barred gate garage in Salisbury between Blackburn and Preston, he had an ex-factory Stirling Moss XK120. And we did a sprint at Woodvale near Southport, and he had about four people driving it, but I got fastest time of day. And he says, "I'll introduce you to Charles Bridges. He's just bought the ex-Graham Hill lightweight E-type." So the phone rings the next day. He said, "Can you be at Oulton Park at 8 o'clock this Thursday?" So I go. I've never driven an E-type of any description, but I'd done a Duckham's oil test there, the Mini 1275S, and I knew the track, and I knew it was an opportunity. And so I drove, you know, as fast as I could, really. And I went 3.5 seconds faster than Charles, the new owner. And he said, "What are you doing on Saturday? This is Thursday." And so I raced the E-Type like 15 times and got beaten once by Ron Fry in a 250LM Ferrari in September of 65 at Silverstone. And Charles then said, "What do you want to drive next year?" Well, because the real path upward was Formula 3. At this point, I'm, 28 years old. I've never driven a single-seater of any kind. So I'd been to Croft and I'd seen David Hobson and Bruce McLaren in these Can-Am Lolas and McLarens. And I said, "Boy, if I had a choice, I'd have one of those Can-Am cars." And he got one.
Wow.
And so on a March, nice morning in Oulton Park, beautiful sunshine, there's this beautiful Lola T70, red, sitting there. And Terry Wells, the mechanic who'd come with the E-Type from London, Charles looks at it and he looks at me and he says, "Bugger you, Redman, I'm driving it first." So I hear him whistling, and Terry went with him in the passenger seat. I hear it whistling around the circuit, comes past the pits into Old Hall on the end of the first lap. And he finished about 2 feet from a giant oak tree that used to be on the apex of Old Hall. And he got out, he said, "That's the last time I'm driving that bloody thing." So we had a good year. Of course, in club races, it was a superior car, but I was now doing internationals as well, where we had a lot of engine problems, cylinder head gaskets. But anyway, at the end of the year, I got a Grovewood Award. There's Chris Lambert, Jackie Oliver, and myself, presented by Jim Clark at the Grovewood in London. And then the next year, 67, Charles said, "Well, I'm cutting back on my racing, but Brother David," there were three Bridges brothers, Charles the eldest, David the middle one, and John the youngest. And he said, "David wants to carry on." Well, David had just had his driver die after an accident at the Nürburgring, John Taylor from Leicester, at the German Grand Prix. I think he'd collided with Jackie Hicks and there was a big fire, and he'd been pretty badly burnt, but he was being released from hospital, but he got an infection. And so David said to me, "Do you want to turn professional?" I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "It means I'll pay you 30 quid a week, guaranteed for a year, with a car and a mechanic." And so that's in 67, that's how I turned professional. So
amazing.
First of all, I mean, my father wasn't very happy at this time because I'm actually working in the grocery business, the family grocery business. And he said to me, "You've got to make your mind up. Do you want to be a grocer or a racing driver?" So I said, "A racing driver, please, Dad." "Oh, right. Well, you can't come back if you, but good luck. All the best." So a week later, David Bridges rings me. He says, "Bit of bad news, Spud." He always called me Spud. I said, "What?" He said, "We can't get that new Brabham that we ordered. And we can't get them new Cosworth FVA engines either. You're not well known enough." So we started with an old Brabham and a bored and stroked SCA, Cosworth 1000cc to 1500. So we struggled a bit, but partway through the year, John Surtees came up. He says, I'll sell you a new Lola T100 with two FVA engines. So then things looked up a bit. But towards the end of the year, David Piper rang and he said, do you want to drive my 250LM, old boy, at the Monterey 1,000 kilometres? So we do that. It's a very wet race, miserable race. And Richard and I finished, I think we were sixth overall, but we were first in the class. And after the race, this tall, rather distinguished gentleman came up. I said, Mr. Redman, I'm David York, the team manager for John Wyer Automotive Engineering. Would you care to drive with the X at the Kyle Army 9-hour race next month, November? Yeah, so X and I won. So, you know, I signed a contract then with John Wyer for 68. And so that's how that all started. And then because of that Kyle Army win, that's why Cooper asked, you know, because the first race was January of 68 at Kyle Army. And of course, the engine, the Maserati engine, pumped oil in every direction from day one. So for this, John Cooper said, Brian, he said, please try and do five laps. We need the starting money.
God.
So we went testing at Goodwood, and it was really pretty terrible. But and I won't name the new sort of chief engineer at that time because he's still alive, I think. But anyway, a few days after we'd been testing, he rang me up in up in Lancashire. Now then, Brian, tell me what it does. So I said, right. I said, you turn in at a, like 120 or 30 mile an hour corner, and it oversteers, and you give it throttle to try and balance it, and it goes back into a huge understeer, and it pushes all the way through the corner till the last third, and then it picks the inside rear wheel off the ground, and it goes back into a big oversteer. So I think I'm going to hear, you know, technical stuff about camber, caster, blah, blah, blah. There's a silence. He says, Brian, he said, I think I've got the answer. So I said, what? He says, we'll lower the rear tire pressures by 3 pounds. So even I, who knew nothing about anything, knew this wasn't the answer.
Nice.
At the Jarama Spanish Grand Prix, Ludovico Scafiotti, the wonderful Italian nobleman, you know, member of the Fiat family, and I qualify last and next to last. I'm last. Halfway through, we're eighth and ninth. Three quarters of the way through, we're fifth and sixth. So I nipped past Ludovico and finished third. So as we're driving around the track on the open Renault after the race, I'm on the left, Denny Hume's in the middle, and Graham Hill's on the right. He'd won. Well, I'm waving to the crowd on the left. And I turned to my right to wave this way. And as I turned to my right, Graham turned to his left and he looked at me and his arm dropped and his jaw dropped. And he said, Christ almighty, don't tell me you were bloody third.
I note, Brian, that you rejected Ferrari in 1968. There's not many people that do that.
Of course, everything was happening in this sort of early 68 period because of winter. And we also, with Jackie, we won the Brandsatz 6 hours and the Spa 1,000 kilometers. And I was also still doing Formula 2, you know, and I'd finished second to Jochen Rindt at Crystal Palace in the Lola T100. And the phone rings, it's engineer Mauro Fogari from Ferrari. Brian, you come to Modena and test a Formula 2. So off I go to Maranello and then to Modena, and I'm testing at Modena. And at lunchtime, Fogari says, Brian, you see over there under the trees in the raincoat? I says, yes. He says, this is Signor Ferrari. But what he means is, go faster, try harder. So now I go to the Nürburgring South Circuit, which, of course, is very similar to the North Circuit, except a lot shorter. It's about 5 miles round instead of 14 and a half miles at that time. So in practice, I'm whistling around, doing the best I can, really. And I come in about 20 minutes from the end of the final qualifying session. And Harry says, Brian, why are you stopping? I said, well, I've gone as fast as I can. He said, Brian, go out and try harder. And so, of course, I go out and drive like a maniac. I went like 0.1 of a second faster. He always said, you're in 10th place. Well, I'd never been in 10th place. I'd been fourth all along. So the race comes, and there are four of us all together. Jack Hicks was the team leader for Ferrari, of course. I think Kurt Ahrens was third, and I was fourth. But we're all together. And we come past the pits on about the third lap. And Ahrens put a wheel off in the dirt and showered me in stones, and one went through my World War II goggles. And it hit me just under the eye, and I thought it had hit me in the eye. But anyway, I stopped. I came to a complete stop, threw my goggles off, and then drove 4 miles around the rest of the circuit. And I get there, and Fergeri shouts, why you stop? Why you stop? I said, He says, it's okay, it's okay. Wear your goggle, spare goggle. I don't have any. Take X. He gave me X's sun goggles, which were pretty good in the sun, but not very good under the trees. And I drove then like a lunatic, really, without one single thought. And I was gaining 2 seconds a lap on the leader, and I finished fourth. I was almost third, and I set a new fastest lap and all the rest of it. So I go back into the sport hotel bedroom, and I just sat on the bed with my head in my hands, going through the whole thing. Go to dinner, Fergeri disappears, comes back. Brian, I speak with Enzo Ferrari. For the rest of the year, you drive a Formula Dewey. And in September, at Monza, Formula Uno.
Wow.
I said, no, thank you. He says, what do you mean, no, thank you? I said, if I drive for Ferrari, I'll be dead by the end of the year. And so, you know, after this very difficult 71 episode with the fire on the target, sorry, I couldn't race for like 4 or 5 weeks. I did actually do a race just a week or two after coming out of hospital, but my helmet was catching on the burnt area up here. And the doctor said, go off for 6 weeks. And so I bought a caravan and towed it to the south of France. So, and whilst there, I'm going out to get washed one Monday morning. And as I'm coming back down to the caravan, this English bloke who knew I was into racing said, did you know that guy who was killed yesterday? I said, who? He said, Rudd something. I said, Rodriguez? He said, yeah, Rodriguez. I arrived back at the caravan in tears. You know, yeah. Marion said, what's the matter? I said, Pedro's dead. Yeah. So that was that. And then, of course, we get back from this damned caravan enforced holiday. And we're in Cone, and I'm watching television. And I see the non-championship Formula One race at Brands Hatch, in which my great, great co-driver for 2 years, Joe Siffert, died in that fire. I mean, he only had a broken ankle, but he was asphyxiated, you know, because there was just no fire, proper fire equipment, you know, at that time. But going back to 71 and the Ferrari episode, so here I am having a pretty hard year, really, not very good at all. But Sid Taylor borrowed a BRM, Can-Am car, from BRM. I think it was a P167. And we go to Imola, 500 kilometers, you know, long race. It rained, and the car was very good in the rain. It was a Tony Southgate design, and all his cars were tended to be softer on the road and therefore better under wet conditions. And I managed to lap the field, which included a factory Ferrari driven by Joey Regazzoni. So after the race, Fergeri comes up to me and says, Brian, what are you doing next year? So 2 great years with Ferrari in the 312 PB. But, you know, how lucky was that?
Yeah.
You know, to be at that place at the right time.
Yeah. You've got to be in it to win it, Brian, you know. I just want to go back to the Targa Florio. Obviously, we spoke about your accident in 71, but you have won and conquered Targa Florio as well. There's a brilliant bit in your book where you say when you won, you know, usually the crowd will cheer at the end of the race, regardless of who wins other than on Sicily when a German team wins with a Brit and a Swiss driver. So yeah, what was it like racing at the Targa Florio?
Well, it was very interesting, really. I mean, yes, when Sifford and I won in 70, as the car crossed the line, they said that there were something like 500,000 spectators all around the track, and there were hundreds at the start-finish. Deadly silent, nothing as we crossed the line or on the podium. And as soon as Nino Vaccarella came across in third place.
That's amazing.
But since then, I've been back a couple of times. Well, and I think it was about 85, I got a call from Porsche. Herr Edmund, you will come to the Targa Florio for a recreation event. I said, yes, great. So off we go. Well, they brought the 983 from the museum. This was the Rodriguez Kinnunen car that finished second. 1970, and all the engineers, and because it's a bit of a holiday, you know, all the managers are there, everybody's there. It's a big turnout. So I'm driving with Hans Hermann, the great German veteran, and we don't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. It's not a race. But then we find out it's a bit like a rally. Your time clock thing, you go slowly through the three villages. And at the end of the village, there's an area, and then you go flat out. And so we'd be flat out for 20 miles, you know, through the mountains and along the straight, all that was the same. And so off I go to do a recce lap in this 908.3. Well, I only go less than a mile, and the brakes come on. I don't try to keep going at all. I just stop. Well, they're waiting for me. So an hour later, two big vans arrive, all the Germans come pouring out. What is the problem here? And I said, well, the problem is the brakes have come on. You know, probably it's been in the museum for 25 years or so. Yeah, this is so. And then the engineer says, Herr Edmund, can I ask you a question? And he said, yes. He said, did you release the handbrake?
No way.
I said, what handbrake? So up behind the dashboard, is a little aluminium lever about this length, and it's attached to a wire that goes to the brake pedal.
Wasn't there before. So,
anyway, Hans and I won, and it was very good. It was well done. And since then, I've been back a couple of times as a tour guide for Steve Austin's Great Vacations. And I must say, the last time we went, which was probably 2 or 3 years ago, we couldn't have been better treated. Richard Atwood was there as well, and we were giving the freedom of a town, Termini Imerese, which is not far off the Targa track, and they gave us gifts and everything. I have some on the shelf back here, paintings and beautiful gifts. It's the best we've ever had anyway, I have to say. You know, getting to know the Sicilians better, that there are no greater enthusiasts. They're unbelievable.
Oh, that is amazing. We've spoken before on Nine Works about visiting Sicily and retracing as much as we can of the old circuit. And yeah, you're just stoking the fire, I think, for that a little bit more, Brian, you know, with these stories. So,
up until a year, not long ago, you couldn't get round the entire track because way out in the boons somewhere, a bridge had collapsed. Yeah. And they'd never repaired it. And I think it may have been done now.
Yeah, that's good. We'll get out there then. I just want to talk. It's just like a couple of things before we wrap up. So long as you've got the time, anyway, Brian, to answer these questions. But like you were hugely successful, of course, in the States from 73 to 76. I'd like to know, you know, what did you like about racing stateside?
Well, first, when I first came to America, which would have been Daytona in 68 for John Wire with Ix in the GT40. I saw how generally enthusiastic people were, and that if you had an idea, you would always find somebody to back it. And that's still the same today to some degree, compared to England, where it's very difficult to actually get anything done. And I liked that. And I liked a general sort of, but, you know, as mentioned earlier, now I hate some of the things that they all take for granted as part of their great freedom. carry a gun down to the grocery store, you know, and show it. All that stuff is crazy. But I like to, you know, when we came to America, it happened because after that 71 episode and driving the McLaren M18 for Sid Taylor in Formula 5000, it wasn't a very good car. And at the end of the year, at the end of 71, I asked Derek Bennett if he could build a Formula 5000 car, and he said yes. And I said, how long and how much? He said, 10 weeks or whatever it cost me. And so I bought the first real racing car that I ever bought. I paid Derek £3,000 for a new Chevron B24 Formula 5000 car. And Sid Taylor provided the engine, the gearbox. Engines were built by Alan Smith in Derby. And Ron, the mechanic, was there. And so the first day of practice at Oldham Park, as with many Chevrons, it broke the lap record. And it won the first two races. So Sid shouts, $20,000 for first place at Watkins Glen in July. We're going. So we put it on an open trailer in Liverpool and ship it to New York. And in New York, because we've no money, we buy a $500 station wagon and tow the Chevron up to Watkins Glen. I'm leading by 25 seconds from Graham McRae with 7 laps to go, and the battery went flat.
Oh.
And so when I got back to the pit, Sid is on the ground, you know, like, I don't know if you knew him, he's Irish, he's like, the effing battery went flat. But anyway, the last race of the year at Riverside, California, I'm slipstreaming Sam Posick, who's leading in his Surtees, and it's the last lap. There's one corner to go, very, very fast, turn 9, slightly banked all the way around. And I come up in some slipstream, and I'm going to pass, but suddenly the back of his car comes at me like this, and I swerve to miss him. We're doing 170 miles an hour. So I win the race. There's a protest. The chief steward comes to me in a strong Lancashire accent. He says, "Now then, Brian, love. I'm Joe Smith from Accrington. Accrington's 5 miles from Burnley, where I lived." He said, "There's one Lancashire lad to another. Stussy, yellow flag, or not?" I said, "No, I didn't." "Right, lad, you're the winner."
How serious is that? Amazing.
$500. Then this smallish gentleman came up to me and he said, "Mr. Edmund, I'm Carl Haas from Highland Park, Chicago. I'm the Lola and Hewland gearbox importer for North America. And I'm forming a partnership with Jung Hall of Chaparral Cars for next year. Would you like to drive?" So that's how all that happened. So
amazing. What a time to live.
The standard chassis, a 330 chassis, was shipped out to Jung Hall in Midland, Texas. And Eric Broadley and I did a lot of testing on what was effectively the works car with Jim Chapman, the chief mechanic at that time, and Davey Evans. Anyway, we get to Riverside in about April of 1973. I've never met Jim Hall or any of the crew at all. Eric Broadley's there, Carl Haas is there. And I drive our car, the one I'd been developing in England with Eric for 3 months, and the Hall car, which I'd never seen before. And I chose the Jim Hall car. It was better. And so we win the race. Jody Scheckter was second. And then the next two races, I was driving for Ferrari in Europe, so missed them. So Kevin Bartlett from Australia took my place at Laguna Seca and managed to crash it, I think. And then Derek Bell took my place at Michigan, but he finished 20-odd seconds behind Scheckter. And so I come back from Mid-Ohio, and I had an overheating problem right from the start of the race. And so it started raining, by which time Scheckter is 27 seconds in the lead. Well, when it stopped raining, we didn't pit for tyres or anything. I then went flat out. I never looked at the gauges again. I went flat out. I caught him on the last lap. And on the tight right-hander onto the back straight, he had carburetors on the Alan Smith engine. I had fuel injection. And carburetors, one of the problems with them, the certain tight corners where you're accelerating hard, they get starved of fuel. So that's what happened to Schechter's engine. I heard it, like that. And I got alongside of her. Now I'm on the inside. The corner at the end of the straight's right-handed, so I'm in the right place. Well, he turned in and hit me. We both spun. And Jim Hall had taken first gear out of the gearbox to save weight. And Jody was first away. So he went and I was second. But I got my own back because the last race of the year in Seattle, on the bottom straight, there was a very tight area, like a chicane, with room for one car. So on the first lap, Jody and I arrived at the chicane side by side, and neither of us lifted. And we hit. I go staggering. I come out and I look in the mirror. I can't see anything for dust. I cross the start finish line at the end of the first lap, 20 seconds in the lead.
Oh, really?
Thank you, Jody.
that is awesome. You left quite a legacy in the States, I guess, for racing. To jump into it a few years later, Brian and Andy and I last year, along with Max, we went to a Rennsport reunion over at Monterey. I've been to the last three and love it. It's a real highlight for us. You're the founder of that show, really, or played a significant part in starting it. Could you just kind of give us a little bit of detail on that?
Yes, it all came about in about 1999 when Bob Carlson, who was the head of public relations for Porsche Cars North America, rang me and he said, Brian, could you go to Sebring in March and test the five factory cars that are coming from the museum that are going to go to Monterey, Laguna Seca, in August? So I tested all the cars, and I wrote an article for Road and Track. And then after that, I rang Bob, and I said, Bob, if you'd send those five factory cars from Laguna Seca to Watkins Glen a few weeks later in September, I'll arrange an all-Porsche race meeting. And that's what happened. And we had a great meeting. And after that, Bob rang me, and he said, Brian, let's do another, and we'll call it Rennsport 1 and have it at Lime Rock in 2001. And that was another great meeting. We were really lucky. It was the first dry weekend of the racing year at Watkins Glen in 2001. And we had an enormous crowd. You know, the roads were all blocked to the great racers. I've got a funny tongue-in-the-cheek video that a friend of mine did. I was driving a 962 for Michael Malfitano, and Derek was driving a very similar-looking 962 for Bill Hoare, the owner, and Bill did a video. I'll send a copy of it to you.
Please do.
Because in practice, Derek had a wheel come off this 962, you know, and so... And Derek Bell's driving the wheels off the 962.
That's amazing. Amazing.
So it was very, very well done. It was good. It was funny. So I nearly missed the race. I've been driving the Collier 983 and it had a misfire. And I'd come in and the race for the 962 was immediately afterwards. And so I was talking to the crew and to Scott George from Collier, you know, about the 983. And somebody rushed up and said, you're in the next race. They're leaving. That's how it started. And then we did another one at Daytona in 2004, and then another one at Daytona in 2007. And there, I think we had the largest group of 917s that were ever in one place, except for when it was introduced to the press in March of 1969. It was funny because, you know, there were 10 factory drivers for Porsche at that time, 6 Germans, 3 English, Vic Elford, Richard Atwood, myself, and Joe Sifford. Well, I'm living in Cone, Lancashire, just north of Burnley. And it's March of 1962. I get a call from Porsche. Now, Redmond, you've come and test your new 917. I thought, why do they want me? You know, they've got six Germans living near Stuttgart, all ready to die for the Fatherland. I thought, I'll have a word with Siffert. So I said, I'll call you back in 30 minutes. Please be sure to call Herr Edmund. I said, I will. So I called Siffert in Switzerland, in Fribourg. Seppi, have you tested the new 917 yet? There's a long silence. He says, no, no, Brian. We let the others find out what breaks first. So I couldn't go. In 1959, I mean, you probably don't know the name of Harry Ratcliffe, who is from Littleborough near Rochdale.
Okay.
He had the fastest Morris 1000 in the world. It had a great engine and he'd made fiberglass wings, you know, mudguards for it, Perspex windows. It was the fastest Morris 1000 in the world. And we'd been at a hill climb at Oliver's Mount in Scarborough, and we're on our way back. He's going to Rochdale, I'm going to Burnley. And he's got his flat cap on, and we stopped for a pint at this pub partway. So he said some of the truest words I ever heard. He says, there's one thing about it, Brian, lad. I said, what? He said, the poor young racing driver of today will be the poor old racing driver of tomorrow.
And has it rung true? Oh, Brian, that is amazing. There's so many like good stories, and like you've given us so much time, and like we're so grateful. If you don't mind, like before we wrap up, we usually ask this at the start, and I know I briefed you on it via email, but we like to ask our guests their first, worst, best, and next. Usually it's in the context of their road cars that they've owned, but if you don't mind, it'd be great to get those answers from you within the context of race cars, obviously, throughout your career.
Right, well, the road cars, because when I was 17, this enthusiastic grandfather of mine, with his mop business, he said, he took me to the local showroom, and there was a Jowett Jupiter special bodied, fixed head by, I think it was Abbott, and he took me to the showroom. He said, see that Jowett there, lad? It's yours when you're 17. Fantastic, Grandpa, thank you. You know. Anyway, a few months later, I got hit by the Inland Revenue.
Oh.
Because what happened was he bought the mop yarn from, it was waste cotton, from Arama Mill, Oldham. And it used to come in giant sacks. They were, four, you know, a flat sheet, really, of sacking, where they put all the yarn in, then they pull the corners together and sew it. So these were delivered every week for making mops. Well, every week when they came to bring new mop heads in this sacking, they took the old ones back and they gave him £1 in cash for each one. Well, he hadn't actually declared this to the Inland Revenue, and so got a very hefty fine. So we go back to the car place again, and he says, I'm sorry, lad, he said, a bit of a problem with the money. And then he said to the dealer, he said, what have you got under £50? So we looked around and we found a 1932 Morris two-seater Tourer for £25. So that was my first car.
That was your first car. Amazing, amazing. All right then, so what about your best car, Brian? Road or race?
Well, probably my best road car. Best
yeah,
race.
As you like. Yeah, yeah, totally up to you.
Well, on the race side, of course, you know, those 4 great years with Chaparral in the Lola Formula 5000 car, those were my best years in racing, really. And it was only, I thought, you know, in 77, I was 40 years old, and this is when they changed the rules, and I thought I've probably got another 5 or 6 years at, you know, at this type of racing, doing reasonably well, because it all came to an end. And of course, at that time, I lived an ideal life. You know, I lived in a beautiful house in Gargrave near Skipton in Yorkshire, which is just in the edge of the Yorkshire Dales. It had 2 acres of walled garden. It was built in the 18th century. In the garage, I had a Porsche 917, chassis number 022.
Wow.
35 miles away, I had a 100-acre farm. And all that came to an end in, you know, 77 when I'd sucked to sell everything, you know, and come to America. And so probably my best road car, in 69 and 70, with Porsche, we could choose any car we wanted, you know, in the Porsche range. I chose a 911S each time. The first year, 69, a silver one with a blue interior, was beautiful, fully opted out. At the end of the year, we could hand it back to Porsche, or we could buy it for, you know, £2,000. It was about half price at that time. You know, I always did that. So those were the best road cars I ever had. And after that, I mean, like today, I don't like spending a lot of money on road cars. And I usually buy a 3 or 4 year old car with low mileage. And today I've got a Cadillac ATS 2015, which I bought 2 years ago with 39,000 miles for $15,000.
Ideal. Ideal.
So I don't have any great desire to have. Yeah, I've got friends here in Vero Beach with McLarens, the latest Ferrari. What are you going to do? You know? It's nice to go down to the, you know, to a restaurant and park it outside so all your friends can see it.
And that's about it.
Otherwise,
yeah.
I don't really care about street cars. Yeah.
I don't think you need to do that, Brian, myself.
Absolutely.
But what about your worst car then?
Worst race car probably was the 917 in 1969. It was built in a tremendous rush due to a change in the regulations. So that when the governing bodies, the FIA primarily and the CIS, you know, they didn't want the Americans to win Le Mans again. They won it in 66 and 67. And so they introduced these new rules where if you had a prototype race car, it had to be 3 litre. But if you made 50 of a particular model with 5 litre, you could have 5 litre. Well, when nobody did it, they then reduced the number to 25. And immediately Porsche built 25 917s, which were a copy of the long tail 908. And really, in its initial year, that first year, it was pretty terrible, really. Nobody knew what the problem was. The drivers, a lot, thought it was the chassis twisting. We know now that it wasn't. If you read Frank Gardner's comments on the Nürburgring, when he and David Piper drove the 917, you'll see that he thought the chassis was twisting, but it wasn't. Because I was part of the test in October 1969 at the Österreichring. It was a Porsche test, but it was when John Wire was taking over the factory team for 1970. So John Wire's chief engineer, John Horseman, who in my opinion was the real brains behind the JW team, and I think David York was there, and there were a couple of mechanics, Emanuel Kugi, and Peter Davis, I think there might have been one more. Yeah. But anyway, it was really a Porsche test. And so Kurt Ahrens was there and I was there. And all the first day, we both drove the 917. And Porsche, we changed everything, which is the ride heights, the caster, the camera, da-da-da-da. Nothing made any difference at all, nothing. And we're doing one lap at a time after a change, maybe two.
Wow.
So in the late afternoon, when we'd finished, John Horseman said, "Look at all these flies on the nose, and there aren't any anywhere else. There's no downforce on the back." So they borrowed tools from Porsche, from the Porsche truck, and they chopped the tail off, really. And I came out the next morning, and it looked like a pickup truck. You know, that long swooping tail had gone. It was a short tail like this. And I was first out, and I did 7 laps. And I came in and I said, "Now we have a race car." Just three seconds faster. And this was all, I'm sure, the Porsche engineers knew what the problem was. But Ferdinand Piëch wouldn't let them do anything that would lose any speed on the Mulsanne Straight.
Right.
He was absolutely asphyxiated with top speed and light weight. That was all Porsche thinking at that time.
Yeah, it was definitely like renowned for ruling with an iron fist as well, I guess. So there's, you know, if he thought contrary to everybody else, then what he thought went, really, from what I know anyway. So
You know, it didn't help much that, you know, they broke in half so easily in an accident. So, you know, when you go to some like Spa or Le Mans, where you're going so fast, And you know, if something goes wrong, it's going to be bad. You remember the first one sold to a private owner, John Wolfe, in 1969. So we arrive at Le Mans, and we can, Sifford and I, as described earlier, we have a choice of a 917 or the new long-tail Spider, 908 Spider. So, first of all, Digby Martlin from Southport, as he was at that time, spins in a straight line, going over the Mulsanne hump in practice, and doesn't hit anything. He drives it back to the pits, gets out, and he said to John, "No, thank you very much, John. I now retire from racing." So Elford and Richard Atwood and myself all begged John Wolfe not to start the race. We said, "Let Herbert Linge start. He was a test driver." And he was entered, you know, he entered. Yeah. No, it's my car. I'm starting. And of course, he was killed on the first lap. You know, we'd have lost control, you know, at the White House, as it was at that time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was difficult. And then you never heard much about all the 917s that broke in half. I know of at least five, that broke in half across the cockpit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all evangelize over that car as, the Le Mans winner, the start of that legacy for Porsche. But, you guys race it. And, I know you describe it in the book as, being absolutely terrifying to drive. So it's nice to hear the other side of the coin on that almost,
And now it's known as the greatest endurance car that ever lived.
Yeah. This is it. Yeah.
In 1970 at Spa, Joseph goes out. He doesn't come round. Mm-hmm. Rodriguez comes in the pit. Sifford has stopped at the side of the track with a flat tire. So they load a tire, a wheel brace, and a jack into the spare 917. They whistle off down to the main straight, and they change the wheel on the side of the road. Everybody's going, Then it happens again. And Sifford's going berserk. And now, this is, it's happened twice. Now they say, "Hey, Redmond, now it is your turn." I said, "There's something the matter. Go slowly." Well, the first four laps, I'm building speed up. And on the fourth lap, I'm flat out down the back straight, which is like 214 miles an hour coming into the kink. I'm on the return straight, which is uphill slightly. It's followed by a flat out right and a flat out left, which are both blind. I turn into the right-hander. The left rear tire comes off the rim, and I go sideways. So now I'm going 180 miles outside. I come back the other way. And I lost feeling of where my steering angle was in relation to the slide. And I'd read in a motor racing book that in a circumstance like that, if you let the go of the wheel, the caster actually would straighten it. And that's what happened. I let go of the steering and the caster straightened it. I arrived back in the pits and Joseph fell on the floor laughing. I said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Brian, you're the color of your overalls."
That night,
Saturday night before the race, I never slept. Perspiration was dripping down my head. I'm thinking, tomorrow I'm dead.
Oh my God! Yeah. Can understand why that's viewed as the worst car, Brian, for you. Lastly, we usually ask for next car. So if you're done buying road cars and you're happy with what you got, perhaps you might like to offer, which of the race cars from your career you would most like to drive again.
Well, just a week ago, this last Sunday at Homestead in Florida, we had our annual Targa 66 Club meeting, which is people who don't want to race but to want to run their cars. Mm-hmm. And this was the 33rd year that we've done it. And the Collier Museum from Naples, who have probably one of the best collections in the world, more than 120 cars, they brought five cars to test. And one of them was our Spa winning 1969 Porsche long tail, and I drove it.
Amazing. What was that like? Yeah.
That was the first time since 1969, and I don't know the track. So it was interesting. Unfortunately, I didn't actually do anything wrong, and didn't miss a gear. And and found, I think, a slight mechanical problem that was likely to occur. And so it all went very well.
That is amazing.
So that was good.
Yeah, that's awesome.
One of the cars, your most enjoyable cars, you know, that I ever drove was that Chevron, the B16 Spider. So it was what became the B19, then the B21, B22. So they're great, great car, fantastic cars. And otherwise, you know, we had a great time in '89 with the Aston. It wasn't fast enough, but it was a great team led by Richard Williams, and we had a good time. It was funny because there was no way it was going to do anything. But like, it was an hour and a quarter to go, and Peter Lavalos, the team owner, said to me, "Brian, would you care to do the last hour?" Well, you know, we're in 11th place. We're not going to get any higher or any lower. So I wasn't really bothered, but I said, "Oh, thank you, Peter." So off I go. And then pretty bored, and Arnage, a right-hander that's about 100 miles an hour or so in the second gear, it would slide very easily. So a few laps, right? And then I didn't. And suddenly, from the right-hand side of the road, some English enthusiasts, some Brits, they held up this big sign, "Give us some oppo."
No.
So I nearly spin it. And then the next time, another big sign, "Now, fastest lap." And the third and final time, "Crumpets and tea with the Queen." So going back to Le Mans in 1967 with Mike Salmon, the team was owned by Lord Down. And of course, he didn't enter it because he didn't want his name associated, you know, with racing particularly. So it was entered by John Noir. And we're staying at the superb Hotel de France at Chateau Sieur le Loire, about 20 miles from Le Mans. Well, all Lord Down's pals were there from England. And I must say, I don't think racing was very high on the curriculum. So on a normal afternoon, it would have been Thursday afternoon. This is the last day of practice, and it's 3 p.m, and the wine and drinks are still going down. And Lord Down says, "What time's practice?" Well, of course, nobody's got the slightest idea. "What time's practice? What time's practice?" So I say, "I think it's at 5 o'clock. "Gone." "Oh." So he says to his younger brother, the Honourable James Dorney, "Get Brian to the track as quickly as possible." So now James is on a mission. And they brought, John Down said, "We brought the old Rolls. We do have a new one," he said, "but we don't trust the bloody French." So off James and I go in this gigantic thing. It's about 10 feet tall. And we're hurtling down this narrow French road towards Le Mans. It's heavily crowned, and the only way the Rolls will sit comfortably is in the middle of the road. So in the distance, I see a De Chevre, also in the middle of the road. And I look at James and I think, he's on a mission. He's not going to change anything. So I start to slide down under the dashboard because there's no seat belt. And as I started sliding down, James stood up and he goes, "Get out of the way, you fucking peasants." because in the race, Mike Salmon came in after the first session, and this is my first time at the mall. I'm nervous. I open the door, and Mike looks at me and says, "I'm terribly comfortable, old boy. I'm staying in." So the French plombeur, who is supposed to just note how much fuel and oil you've taken, he shuts the filler cap, you know, this giant snap-action can.
Yeah.
Of course, Mike goes out, and at the end of the Mont Saint, at about 200 miles an hour, clamps the brakes on. The fuel surges forward, the cap comes open, and tremendous fire. Mike was badly burned, but recovered and lived to race again. The car was pretty well destroyed, but also lived to race again.
So many tales, Brian. It's so different to what we know today. I think it's been really nice to shine a light on that again so that people can appreciate, you know, again, it's the bravery is the word I use. I know you might kind of not quite agree with that, but it's just fantastic for you to cast a light on it. Like, we are honestly so grateful that you've been able to join us today on Nine Works Radio and just share some of these stories. It's such a privilege, like, hearing them, you know.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Every time we talk about something, I keep remembering something else.
No, it's great. I mean, you know, if you're happy to, we'd love to have you on again, because we've scratched the surface, really, as you know, and you're such a great storyteller. I could listen to you all day, you know. So, maybe we could do that going forward. But for now, it'd be prudent to sign off as a fantastic conversation with a living legend from automotive racing. Co-founder, really, of Rennsport Reunion, and also, as we've discovered, perhaps the world's greatest undiscovered impressionist.
You know? What do you mean?
Fantastic. Well,
we know how to deal with people like you.
Brilliant. Brian Redman, thank you so much for joining us on Nine Works Radio.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed that chat with the legendary Brian Redman. Yeah, what a pleasure, what a privilege, and a really nice way to sign off for the first 100 episodes of Nine Works Radio. Yeah. So thank you, Brian, for your time all the way from Florida.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Appreciated. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have a couple of things to tie up the 100th episode. Max, we've got a gem of the week.
We have.
We've got to make it big. Is it big?
Gem of the week, which is fitting of the 100th episode. So much so that I think, Lee, you know exactly what I'm about to say.
I know exactly.
Read my mind.
My mind is saying you are going to Paragon and you are going to the 993 GT2R. That just absolute motorsporting history on wheels sitting there as it is currently.
It's got to be, hasn't it? It's got to be. And what an appropriate one for the 100th episode, but also having had Brian on, you know, not a car of his era, but, you know, a proper Porsche racing car.
Yeah.
And what a wicked thing it is.
Yeah.
What a brilliant bit of stock for Paragon.
Without a doubt. And actually, you know, that car in being built for the BPR series, and it was Jürgen Barth is the B in BPR, and Jürgen is a previous guest on Nine Works Radio. I think it was spring 2023 we spoke to Jürgen. So again, a nice tie in there with a former guest. But that period of history, I said on social media yesterday, is becoming ever more popular with collectors anyway. You know, that late, or the 90s and early 2000s as well, whereas before it was all about, you know, the heyday of kind of Porsche racing was the 80s. And I think in terms of success, it's hard to argue against that. But just popularity of these cars as real collector pieces now, that millennium era is really coming into its own.
Yeah, it really is. You know, the Peter Auto series is very popular. I mean, what a great car. Have you seen it? Have you been to Paragon whilst it's been there?
Yes, I did see it. Probably a couple of weeks ago now, a few weeks ago, but I didn't realise it was for sale. So I didn't have as much of a look around. Well, I think, is it Stefan Ortelli is a former driver on it? Because I remember taking a picture of it and sending it to him. And obviously Stefan being a legendary guy in Porsche circles for being one of the drivers that pedalled the GT1 to victory in 1998 alongside Alan McNish, for example. If this is the car I'm thinking of, I think he was a former driver.
Yeah. I'm trying to look and see if his name's on the door. Ah, there we go. There is an old picture. There is an old picture with Ortelli. Yeah.
He's in it.
Contemporary pictures.
Amazing.
When it was red.
There we go.
Yeah. There we
go. Cool. What else is special about the car then, Max, either in spec or history?
Well, it's a very rare car. Let me have a look. How many did they deliver of this? Let me get back to the,
So was it a GT?
GT2R.
So it's a 1996 GT2R. So a 993 generation GT2R.
Yeah.
Delivered in January 1996 to Par Motorsport. So it's got some nice UK Porsche history, which I always like. And they ran it in the, as you say, Lee, the BPR Global GT Series in 1996. And then it was upgraded by Rook, you know, the well...
Rook Racing,
racing outfit. They upgraded it to Evo spec, and then they ran it in the FIA GT Championship from 97 to 99. So that's a really nice bit of history.
That's a nice history, yeah.
And so that means the car ran at Le Mans, so that's always nice. You know, a car with Le Mans provenance makes, I think it makes any car a special car if it's run at Le Mans, doesn't it?
Yeah. What sort of horsepower is that? 550, 600?
It's got to be around that, you know, yeah. It was funny, the mid to late 90s with the GT2, as Max pointed out. It was funny, they, you know, it went GT2, because even with like the street car, they then realised, oh, if we bolt this turbocharger on, we get another 20%. Yeah. So then it went to GT2 Evo, and it's the same with this. It was like year on year, it went up and up and up. I can't remember where this one sits, if I'm honest. I'm sure it was selling the marketplace.
465 horsepower, 1120 kg.
Does it mention the torque at all?
Doesn't mention the torque.
It's going to be lumpy, isn't it?
It's going to be
lumpy.
Yeah.
It's going to romp on, as they say, isn't it?
Yeah. Romp on, yeah.
Oh, senior. I can feel the force.
Yeah.
Oh, just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
very.
Good choice, Max.
Very cool. Yeah, great choice.
Was it silver with red graphics, yellow headlights?
Yeah.
Full race spec.
Yeah, silver, black centre lock BBS, yellow headlights. Bit of livery, Swiss flag, Le Mans stickers. You know, just needs a handbrake and an MOT and you're away, eh?
Boom.
Yeah. I was all in for it, but as you know, guys, silver cars don't do it for me. So I'm going to respectfully drop out of the running for this one.
Yeah.
I know the £1 million asking price is definitely contributes to that a little bit as well. But yeah.
But that maybe wasn't going to be the thing that held you back, really, was it?
No, not at all. It's just the silver, really. I just can't do silver cars. If not, I was well there.
Says the owner of a silver car.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic. It's a fitting gem of the week. And yeah, as I said, that era for race car collectors is really coming into its own now. So congratulations. And even if you're passing Paragon, pop in, have a cup of tea and have a look at it, because it is it's a thing of beauty and a key point of history, really.
Mega thing.
Amazing. Have we got anything else to tie up before we sign off?
I've got a spread the love. I don't know if anybody else has got any.
Always got time for a spread the love.
I came across I'm on YouTube again, obviously.
Okay. Yeah.
I came across a really useful channel, not to me, but I think it will be to Max and anybody else that's got a, what have you got? A 981. I can never remember.
981,
yet. Yeah, 981. There's an Australian guy called Jeff Richardson, and that's the... His YouTube channel is called Jeff Richardson. Jeff Richardson, that's right. And he has got a load of videos on 981s. So what he's a bit of a tinkerer. He bought, I think he was very much into BMWs, but then bought a 981 and was like, I love this car, I love the engineering of it. But he's always done lots of fix-in type videos. So on BMWs, he'd do like how to rebuild your engine, sort of that sort of thing. But his 981 wasn't going wrong. There was nothing going wrong in it.
Mm.
So he actually bought another 981, which was a damaged loss. I think it was a flooded car.
Okay.
Bought it really cheap and has basically used that car to do videos on how to fix your 981.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
But he's got some really good videos. I've only watched a couple, but the sort of general, your quality of what he's doing and the ethos of it really... thought it was great. It's
okay,
worth a watch. So yeah, anybody that's got a 981, or I guess it probably transfers across to a 997 as well, because he actually looks at very much the relationships between the Boxster and the 911 and how many parts are actually transferred across. There's a particular video that is, it's called the 911 secret, which goes into that, which is quite astounding, that how much money they make out of a 911 compared to a Boxster,
in
the, you know, the cost, the price, the actual list price,
it's
all about making money. The 911 is the one that makes the money. The Boxster is really a bit of a loss leader, so yeah, some great videos. Jeff Richardson, check
love
that
it.
Out
love
how's
it
that, how's that Jeff spelled? Is that
J-E-F-F
Jeff, look at that.
Jeff or Geoff?
Not Geoff, proper Jeff.
Actual Jeff,
proper Jeff. Yeah, that's why my recommendation
you have to do
for this
a lot
week.
Of editing on this episode.
I know. Yeah, no, it's going out as it is.
It can't go out as it is. But gem of the week. Blimey.
Well, right,
who's next? Have you got one? Or do you want me to go?
You go, Max. 100%.
I'm going to print this week for gem of the week.
Old school.
Old school. Like where I come from, which people will know if they've listened to Head Over Wheels. So this is a magazine that I don't subscribe to, because you can't subscribe to everything. But I buy it every now and again, and I ordered it only just the other day because I saw that it had something about Group C cars in it, and it's Magneto magazine.
Oh,
so that arrived in the post at today, and as I took it out, I just thought, what a beautifully designed thing this is. You know, it's a lovely quality item. You know, the feel of it, the look and feel of it, it's a nice thing to hold. It's beautifully put together. It's got a great article, the cover article about Ayrton Senna. So 30 years on from his death, interviews with people who knew him and worked with him, looks brilliant. It's got the Group C, which is the top 50 Group C cars, which is the reason why I bought it. But I always look at the people who've contributed to any magazine that I'm reading, and Dickie's in there, Dickie Meaden, Adam Towler's in there, you know, some real high quality contributors. So yeah, it's a cool issue of a, you know, of a really nice magazine.
Nice. What's the other magazine that's like Magneto?
Road Rat.
Octane?
No, Octane. So yeah. Octane have been bought by Magneto.
Yes.
Which is bizarre, because Octane was like the mag, and I believe that then a few guys went away from Octane and created Magneto.
I think that was that David Lillywhite.
It was. So yeah, it's like the child has bought the father. It's amazing how it goes round, isn't it? Yeah.
It's like a Netflix documentary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Netflix drama, sorry. Succession.
Yeah.
No, good.
That is good.
Right, and you?
I just want to give a slight mention. So with
What does that mean?
I don't really know, really. That's
give it a full mention. Go for it.
Yeah, I'll go full ham. So we've done a few bits and pieces before with Charade, their UK-based being in Cannock. We've spoken to Leon for 10 minutes on a previous episode about opening up a new premises at Bristol. Well, that is like fully open now, and we are going to be hosting an event there in May. Can't go as far as to confirm it just yet because I'm waiting for an email back. But the plan is we're going to do a Cars and Coffee and we'll do a live podcast there because they're always good fun. And so it's just a bit of a shout out really that Charade Accident Repair have now opened a centre in Bristol. And it's worth remembering that when you do have an accident in your car, and unfortunately it does happen, it's part of life, you have a right to take it absolutely anywhere you want. So the Charade empire is expanding, not just to Cannock now, but we've got Bristol, I think, also looking at somewhere in the Cotswolds as well. So if you're that kind of way, it's worth dropping in. The big thing about those guys is they're Porsche recommended. So there's certain standards that they have to adhere to and are vetted on continuously to ensure a certain standard of quality. So it's going to be really interesting in a couple of months to take some of the DNHC around Charade and so have a look in at what's gone on there and the investment that goes into making something that's Porsche approved. But in the meantime, yeah, just a shout out to say worth considering those guys, I'd say.
Pop in and get a quote.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Charade Bristol. And it's not just accident repair. They do like restorations and all sorts. If there's anything remotely bodywork that you need, yeah, give them a shout.
Good
stuff. I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to that dropping into the diary. And going down there.
Bit of Brizzle.
Absolutely, a bit of Brizzle.
Yeah.
Brizzle.
Are we going to go and do a bit of Cheddar Gorge?
A drive up on the way through. Yeah, it'd be great.
Sounds good plan.
Yeah, it's a great shout. Nice little drive, that.
Cool.
It's nice.
Yeah, super. All right, then we'll sign off the 100th episode. Want to say thanks.
Do an update.
Oh, yeah. Go for it. Sorry. Yeah, my bad.
I've got a little update for some new members of the DNHC. First up is somebody that you know quite well, Lee.
Oh dear.
He bought your 957 from you.
Is he? He's after me, is he?
Yeah, he's come to get you. Rod Cates. I think I've pronounced that correctly.
Yeah.
Here's the guy that bought your KN about probably a year ago.
It was a year ago. Yeah. Wonder if he's still got it.
It must be still going if he's joined up.
It's out there somewhere.
Yeah, this is the thank you.
Yeah.
He would like to join because he fancies doing a UK or Europe trip in his 996. Previously done Stelvio Pass on his motorbike, so I'd like to do a similar sort of thing on his 996.
Amazing. I think from memory, we had a lovely chat on the day Rod came to collect the Cayenne on his 996. I think from memory, he's got a couple of CSR bits on it from RPM Technic. I think certainly been there for some fettling. So like 996, like outlaw style.
Is he down Devon way?
He is, yeah, that's it, yeah. So it's great to have you on board, Rod, 100%. Let us know if you've still got that Cayenne as well.
Yeah, I've given you a shout on WhatsApp. I haven't heard back from him yet to get him joined up. So, yeah, shout. Okay, next up is Danny Walls, who is up north in Scarborough, or as he likes to call it, Scarbados?
Scarbados.
Scarbados.
Love it. Love it.
Danny has got his dream car, which is 2004 Atlas Grey 996.2 GT3 in full comfort spec.
Nice.
Which is, is, as I said, his dream. He also has a little 2.7986 Boxster, which is yellow with yellow colour matched. Yeah. Body wheels.
Club sport vibes. Club sport vibes. Yeah.
Looks cool.
That's rad.
What wheels are they? They could be, are they cut ones on it, actually?
I can't remember.
I think they could be cut ones. So like, are, you know.
Nah, I don't know. I think they might be the stock wheel, but.
Colour matched. Anyway, look cool. Speedy look cool.
With the club sport decal, as it would have been on a 968 club sport. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is awesome. Loving the sound of that.
Yeah, and Danny's also been talking up the roads around Scarbados.
Yes.
Best in the country, he reckons.
North Yorkshire Moors Road. Visited.
Excellent.
Bring a tissue just in case you get a nosebleed if we go and visit him.
Well, yeah, anything above Winchester. It's a long
way north.
Us,
it's a long way north. But yeah, I might take that what's the word? Invitation up.
Absolutely.
Right. Mark Mills, rookie driver who is based near Headcorn in Kent. He was, I think he knows us through Paragon because he does their PPF
cool man
side of things. So Mark drives a lovely black 1986 930 turbo, which was a real poster car for him. I think he's had a bit of history with that over the years, and he's also got a TVR Griffith.
Oh wow. Okay.
Which I really desire one of those.
Do you really?
Yeah. I do. It's been on my list for many, many years.
Don't get your driveway done if you buy one of them. They drop a load of oil, don't they?
No, they're all right. Yeah. Just a bit sketchy on the back end.
Yeah. what a garage that is, by the way. 930 and a TVR Griffith. That's doing it properly.
That's pretty cool. Dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah. A little bit of jeopardy in there.
Yeah, good lad.
Love it.
Yeah, so Mark, welcome. And lastly is Rowan Davis, who's a Works Plus driver. He is from Essex, drives a 993C2, and apparently he was found on the roadside by a group of our members where they had a chat, and Rowan decided he wanted to join up.
Amazing. Yeah,
so thank you, whoever that was. It was out on the side of the road.
Yeah, we owe somebody a beer there, I think. And Rohan as well, and being a Works Plus driver, will get the monthly subscription to T911, Total 911 magazine, complimentary. Yep. So thanks for signing up on that, Rowan. That's awesome.
Looks like a lovely car as well, 993 Carrera Coupe. You know, it just looks correct. I think it's iris blue, if I remember correctly.
I haven't seen the pictures of it yet.
Wheels. There's a picture of it on the collective WhatsApp.
Because he only joined the WhatsApp this morning, isn't he? I haven't been on there yet this morning.
It's just today, so. It just looks like, you know, the picture that you have in your mind. If someone says, oh, you know, think 993, I think iris blue coupe with 17-inch wheels. And that's what it is.
Beautiful. Lovely. Absolutely beautiful. Lovely. That's awesome. That's really nice. Anything else?
That's Andy, it. Or? That's brilliant. It for this week.
Super duper. Well, look, we just want to sign off, I guess, by saying, even if you've listened to 1 minute of the 100th episodes that we've done, like, a massive thank you, because you're helping contribute to Nine Works Radio and everything about it. So we are really, really grateful. I guess all we ask going forward is maybe just to share it with a friend. If you're at a Cars and Coffee, just give us a little bit of a mention. That would really help us out, I guess, as well as leaving a review, particularly if it's a positive one.
Yeah. Actually, we haven't had any reviews, I don't think, on the podcast for a while. So, yeah, if we could have a little push for some reviews, that'd be most welcome.
It would be, very
fancy,
nice.
Fancy dropping on either the Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify, actually. In Spotify, you can actually feedback on each episode. Okay. Which is a fairly new thing. So if you use Spotify, maybe you could have a little review on each episode. That would be fantastic.
That would be absolutely lovely. So yeah, you know, basically, if we don't have an audience and it's just like, you know, the three of us sitting around talking about cars, which I've always maintained, we would do it anyway. But it's nice to share our experiences and also some of the people we talk to. So genuinely, if you've even listened to 1 minute, we are exceedingly grateful, and we look forward to bringing you more.
Indeed.
And see, if you do listen to 1 minute, don't listen to Gem of the Week.
It's all right. I will edit it. Excellent. Right. See you next week.
See you next week for episode 101.
101.
See you later.
This episode was brought to you by our very kind Driven Not Hidden collective. If you would like to join the collective to get further access and rewards within the NineWorks community, you can do so at patreon.com/NineWorks. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review on your favourite podcast app.